Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, earlier in the year, Andrew Fuller of Des Moines won the Netflix baking competition show Is It Cake? He'll stop by to talk about his future plans. But first, Orchestra Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids, is celebrating its 100th anniversary this season. The season has gotten off to a rocky start, with bad weather getting in the way of their annual Bruce Morchestra outdoor concert. But Orchestra Iowa has endured far more in the past, and there's still a great season ahead. Orchestra Iowa is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio, and with me now is Tim Hankowich, director of Orchestra Iowa. Hello, Tim.
Hello, good to see you.
Wonderful to have you here. And Gretchen Brumwell is also here. She's the principal harpist for Orchestra Iowa and has been with the organization since 1995. Hello, Gretchen.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you both so much for being here. And I was watching the weather the weekend of Bruce Morchestra, and I'm so sorry. That was the weekend with all the lightning when the Hawkeyes played until 1:30 in the morning.
That's right, yeah.
It just went on and on.
Well, you know, you're a genius when the weather works, and you're a bum when it doesn't. And it's, oh, dear. But, you know, you can't argue with Mother Nature once she's made up her mind.
Well, and that's a lesson that Orchestra Iowa has had to learn multiple times. It's been a rocky couple of decades for Orchestra Iowa with Mother Nature. In 2008, of course, the terrible floods, you lost your theater for several years.
Well, it also forces you to be resilient. Because what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think if you go through the entire history of the orchestra that predates both of us, it's the times, these nodes of adversity that actually were the impetus for step change. Certainly the flood of 2008 really completely changed the orchestra and the complexion of the orchestra. Certainly the pandemic has. And weather, yeah.
Right, the derecho.
The derecho.
The derecho as well took out a large portion of your library.
Our library
right?
was destroyed, and we were able to replenish it. And now we have one of the largest libraries that any orchestra would kill for. So, I mean, there's always a silver lining that comes out of adversity. Hopefully your organization, whatever that may be, is resilient enough to learn those lessons and to bounce back from it.
Right. So you came in 2006, right,
yes.
Jim? And then the floods came 2 years later. Did you think about leaving?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking of what my dad told me long before I thought I was ever going to be a musician. He said, Tim, you can either get a job and climb the ladder, or you can stay and make a difference. And I remember, things were looking pretty bleak in 2008. We had maybe 4 months of operating capital. We had no place to play. Everything was destroyed. Everybody was scattered to the winds. And I did think about cutting and running. And that was actually the moment when I decided to stay, because I saw the grit of the people in this area who were rebuilding their lives, rebuilding their homes, including Gretchen here. And how it really defined the character of the people in the community. And that was something I'm still kind of choking up now that I hear that, because made a huge difference in my life.
Gretchen, why don't you take us back to that time as somebody who lives in the area, and you'd been part of Orchestra Iowa for a long time. I'm sure losing the theater was probably not the biggest part of what was going on in your life. But did that feel like that might be the end?
You know, it was such an impactful time for all of us in Cedar Rapids. My family personally, we lived a block from the river, and so we lost our house. Mm. So we were dealing with all of that. But I know just even processing what to do about all the various aspects of your life, including Orchestra Iowa, thinking through the instruments that were there. I know we had one of our percussionist Alan Lawrence got into the Paramount and rescued a bunch of instruments, but I hadn't even wrapped my brain around that part of it. I didn't think about what the symphony harp was doing. I was so much processing our own lives,
your own personal,
and so I think the community was just in shock. But it was as we all recovered, it was truly wonderful to see the community come together. It I know we went from the feeling of how can we manage this? There's just no way, to just marveling at the kindness of strangers and how the community just pulled together and did so much, not only for those of us who personally lost things in the flood, but for organizations like Orchestra Iowa, and just stepped up and really showed how much they valued us.
Let's travel back in time to before either one of you were part of this organization. You're celebrating your centennial. So,
as is Iowa Public Radio, by the way.
As is Iowa Public Radio. That is
true. 1923 was a good year.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely. So Orchestra Iowa's first performance was in April of 1923. So tell me a little bit about what it meant for an orchestra to come together at that time.
Yeah.
What do we know?
So if you think back then, recording industry, broadcasting industry was certainly in its infancy. So music was not as accessible as it is now. It's almost as common as water from a tap today. But back then, if you wanted to hear music, you had to make it yourself. And a community leader once said, you know, shouldn't Cedar Rapids have a symphony? And it's what a great idea. And so as often as these things happen, it started off with a group of committed amateurs who played instruments. And by the way, a lot more people back then played instruments as part of their daily lives.
You had to do something in the
evening,
right?
They had to do something, yeah. And so they got together, and with the support and help of Coe College and Joseph Kitchen, who was the first music director, who was there for like 30 years, I think, they started what is now become Orchestra Iowa, this long, never-ending journey of a symphony orchestra.
And back then, it was more of an amateur
yes.
type production.
Yeah.
When did it professionalize?
Well, I think that's sort of a natural progression that happens with most orchestras. It starts off with amateurs, and then all of a sudden they say, "Well, we need a harpist. Do you know a harpist?" "Well, no, I don't, but I know there's this one who lives maybe 40, 50 miles away. Well, how are we going to get them here? Well, we better at least pay for their mileage or somehow to entice them here. Or we would really love to do this piece, but we just don't have enough string players." And then after a while, a fundraising mechanism starts developing, and then as the repertoire and the aspirations of the orchestra become larger, it is just a natural progression from amateurism into professionalism, and that's something we're still going through even to this day.
Well, and Gretchen, you can tell us a little bit about this. Of course, there are several professional orchestras in Iowa, some really wonderful professional mm-hmm. orchestras in Iowa. What is it like for a musician to be part of a professional orchestra? And I know many musicians will be part of several professional orchestras because this is kind of a difficult way to make a living.
Absolutely. Yeah. Being a musician in Iowa is a special challenge because, as you're saying, even though we have fabulous orchestras here, none of them are full-time orchestras. And so all of us have to make a living from various pieces. And so through the years, that has looked different for those of us who are musicians of Orchestra Iowa. But all of us are putting a life together from various strands. For me personally, I really enjoy that about being a musician in Iowa, because in many larger metropolitan areas, if you're the symphony musician, that's all you do. And you play symphony concerts week after week after week. Whereas here in Iowa, I get to play symphony concerts, I get to play ballet, I get to play operas, and then on the side I go and I play for private engagements, and I get to teach college students, and I get to teach beginners, and it's this very varied life as a musician instead of just being one track musician. And I know a lot of us in the orchestra do similar things. And that's something that I personally enjoy, even though it brings its own challenges.
Well, and of course, you're local, but a lot of the musicians are not, right?
Correct. Yeah, we have actually almost 20% of our musicians come from Chicago. And we have some selected musicians that come from a long distance, including some that come from as far away as Indiana to play with us. So it's a unique situation where so many are coming from other places.
So in preparing for a performance, how often does the whole group actually get to be together to rehearse?
There will be a kind of a condensed set for each concert so that we have several rehearsals just in the couple of days immediately prior to a concert.
All right. So, yeah. Tim, that sounds like a pretty exciting, possibly quite stressful
time.
It is
a whirlwind, yes. Four rehearsals for a Masterworks, 1 to 2 rehearsals for a Pops, and occasionally what I call one rehearsal wonders. Sometimes we just put together a program under one rehearsal. And yeah, that is... I used to have a full head of hair, and I no longer have it because of that.
So, Tim, of course, you already mentioned the pandemic, which has been so difficult for musical organizations everywhere, and strange.
Sure.
And also a time of innovation and creativity in some ways as well, although you had the derecho in the middle of that as well. So you got a kind of a double dose as an organization. But has that changed the willingness and interest of musicians in traveling?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's a big question mark that we're still sort of sorting out. Because up until the pandemic, I think you could have said that our musicians were just coming from farther and farther away. We do audition in Chicago, but even the local auditions that we have, many of the people who are winning these auditions are coming from Chicago and other places now. And so that was sort of a trajectory that I thought was going to be continuing just naturally. But with the pandemic now, I know a lot of musicians who epitomized the gig economy were hit excruciatingly hard. And many very talented and wonderful musicians that I know made the very difficult decision not to continue as a musician anymore. And so I think we've seen a decline in just the number of musicians that are available now. And I suspect there will be a reluctance to commute as much as people were used to in the past. I don't know, but I think that's where we're going.
Well, we'll talk what we do know about the evolution of Orchestra Iowa more in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. Tim Hankowich, director of Orchestra Iowa. Gretchen Brumwell is also here. She's the principal harpist for Orchestra Iowa, and they are celebrating their 100th anniversary this season. We'll find out more about the season to come in a moment as well. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, I will talk with Baker Andrew Fuller, known by some as Sugar Freak Show. He'll be here in a little while. Right now, we're talking about Orchestra Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids. It is celebrating its 100th anniversary this season with a lot of special events planned. Orchestra Iowa is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio, and Tim Hankowich, director of Orchestra Iowa, is here. Gretchen Brumwell is also here, principal harpist for Orchestra Iowa. And before we focus on this season to come, which will begin. It did not begin with Bruce Orchestra as planned, but will begin not this weekend, but next weekend. Tell me a little bit, and Gretchen, I'll let you go first. You started with the orchestra in 1995, and we've talked about some of the really difficult events that you as an orchestra, as a group, have had to endure with the flood of 2008, with the pandemic, with the derecho, and how you have had to adjust and be resilient. How do you feel like the organization has evolved to what it is today? What do you think is different now than what you found in 1995?
Well, I would say there are several notable differences. When I came in 95, one of the things that was very different for us as musicians was the schedule. as Tim and I were talking, the current schedule is very condensed around one weekend with a concert weekend. When I came, we were rehearsing like every other evening over a 2-week period for an upcoming concert. And so that made it very community focused. Almost all of us lived in town and did other things during the day. And so at that point, we had our executive director was one of the musicians. Kathy Hall was our principal bassoonist. And it was very much a community symphony. Over the evolution of the years, as we have been bringing in more and more people from out of town and condensing the schedule so much, that has both opened up some real opportunities where people can commute in to play with us. It also just brings unique challenges with it. It's difficult, especially for some of the instruments, to have double rehearsals in a day. It's a physical challenge.
Sure.
And so that brings some challenge with it. But again, there are some opportunities. It just is a different sort of a schedule for us. Another huge change has been watching the growth into Iowa City over the past decade or so. And that's just been wonderfully exciting to see it move from very Cedar Rapids focused to being a true corridor symphony with Iowa City and Cedar Rapids. And that's been a wonderful growth to see.
Well, and I can imagine that the time when you didn't have the theater probably really enhanced that, because you had to perform all over the place. I remember seeing lots of Orchestra Iowa concerts in many different locations.
Hence our name change. I mean, for 7 years, we were playing in Mason City and Fairfield and Independence and Iowa City and Cedar Rapids and everywhere and anywhere they would have us. And so our name really reflected our new reality.
The evolution from your perspective, Tim, of course, you've been here since 2006, as you were talking earlier about your decision to stay in 2008. I mean, that must have also really enhanced your relationship to this organization. Did it change your vision for this organization too?
Yeah. When you're facing an existential crisis, you really have to ask yourself, is it worth it? And it certainly was. And this was something that is essential for this community to thrive. Any organization's mission is to earn its relevance each and every day. And that is a mission that I accepted gladly, especially in the light of seeing all this incredible character coming from our community. And so over the years, what I've seen and what keeps me coming back is every once in a while, at least once a season, maybe twice. I mean, all our concerts are good, but every once in a while, magic happens on the stage. And it has nothing to do with me, although I will take the credit for it. where we rehearse and everything's fine, but, you know, 2-3 measures in, everybody just seems to be on. And everyone seems to feel like we're just levitating. And when you think, wow, that was great. That's the drug that keeps all of us coming back. But it also is wonderful when you've just given that to your audience and they've appreciated it. They understand it too.
Well, and I think we appreciate it even more after the 2 years of the pandemic where live music was so hard to come by. But, you know, live music moves us, different kinds of live music move us in different ways. But that experience of being in an audience with a full orchestra where this magic is happening and you physically feel it because you're in the room. That's something that we could not get through those Zoom performances, could we?
That's the Achilles heel of live performance. And so as you can do so many things operationally through Zoom, but when your core mission, your core reason for being is taken away from you, there are so many arts organizations and symphonies that were struggling. Like, do we do these virtual performances? Because we were so afraid of losing contact with our constituencies. Artistically, in retrospect, I'm not sure it was necessarily a great idea. But it was at least something to keep the musicians engaged and your audiences engaged. But it really kind of took the soul out of what we're supposed to be doing, why we are there.
Yeah. Well, and as you mentioned, you saw musicians decide to quit. I mean, Gretchen, what was that like as a musician for you to go so long without live performance?
It was very bizarre. You know, I love orchestra playing. And during the pandemic, it was such a challenge for all of us, of course. It was a wonderful blessing that we were able to still teach on Zoom. I credit my students for sticking with it, and even a couple of them for starting brand new harp lessons. Nice. During the via Zoom, which is its own challenge. But then I remember the first orchestra concert, which happened to be I was playing with the UNI Orchestra that time after the pandemic, and it just felt like I was waking up. It just felt like coming out of a very long sleep and just, wow, this is so wonderful again to be here. And now going forward, I do have a newfound appreciation for it. I always loved being on stage and performing with an orchestra, but it just, every time I get on stage now, it feels like it's such a privilege to be here, to be part of this.
You can't take it for granted anymore.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about this centennial season, which did not start with the Bruce Orchestra concert. Sorry to keep bringing that up.
Yeah, yeah. You can stop anytime
right.
now. Yeah.
All right. But you do have your masterwork series that is starting very soon. Tell me about that, Tim.
Oh, my goodness. So our theme for the year is 100 years into our future. I think orchestras across the nation there's a danger of us turning into museum pieces. So what will the future look? How do you honor your past and also look forward to the future? One is writing love letters to the future by commissioning new works. Jerry Owen, for example, a local composer, one of my favorite people, has written a piece for us called Towering Oaks, inspired by the pandemic. So there's lemon out of lemonade, or lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah.
Michael Dougherty, of course, is we're performing some of his music. Nancy Cobb has written a piece for us. Michael Gilbertson, who is from Dubuque but now lives in San Francisco. So that's one way of sort of adding on to hopefully future generations that will be playing symphonic music. Some of our guest artists, they're idols of mine. We've dug a little deep into the budget for guest artists that would normally be sort of not really within our scope. Next weekend, Jimmy Lin, he goes by Jimmy, his formal name is Cho Lang Lin. When I was a student in Aspen and he was performing there, I was like following him around like a puppy dog. He wouldn't know who I am because it was kind of creepy how I was sort of stalking him. And he's one of the world's greatest violinists. And so I look forward to that first rehearsal when I open my mouth and just blah, 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 blah comes out, because whenever I meet famous people, I just sort of like come across with the IQ of a garden tool. Same thing at the end of our season, Garrick Olson. One of the great pianists of all time. I mean, and he's playing his party piece, the Grieg Piano Concerto, which is going to be, oh my God, great. You know, so being able to meet some of your idols is great. You know, I was just thinking off air, 100 years ago, 1923, a lot of the repertoire that we play and love and adore was written afterwards. Mm. And that is like still blowing my mind right now. We're beginning our season with Concerto for Orchestra by Bartok, written in 1940-something. One of the great, great, great pieces of all time. And wow, it wasn't even a thought when the Cedar Rapids Symphony first started. So
that kind of explodes some stereotypes that people who may not go to symphony concerts all that often might have, that this music is frozen in time.
Right. It is very much a log of the progress of a symphony, and to be able to play all this music and know that our orchestra actually predates it is kind of neat, I gotta say. I'm not lying here. And then there's some other things. For example, Connor Hanick is coming, and people in the immediate area would know. He's from Iowa City, but he has gone on to perform with the New York Philharmonic, and I think this year he is performing with the San Francisco Symphony. I mean, he's become a real big deal in his career. And so to have him come home for our 100th, I mean, that's great musical birthday cake right there. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Well, and we have this is not a preview because this is not Connor Hanick performing this piece, but one of the featured pieces is Brahms' Concerto for Piano and Orchestra No. 1. And here's a little taste of it as recorded by Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
just a little taste.
Oh, I'm already excited about doing that piece. Isn't that gorgeous?
Yes, it's fabulous. Incredible. And Gretchen, what are you most excited about this season?
Well, as Tim mentioned, there are some very exciting premieres that I think will be wonderful to just experience some new things. I'm also very excited to that we, in February, get to have the Harlem String Quartet as our guest. And that's so unusual to have a quartet be the soloist with the symphony. That will be a really unique thing, and they're such a special group.
Yeah, very cool. And with a professional orchestra, given the environment that we live in now, Tim, you and I have talked in the past about nurturing excitement for classical music, nurturing that future audience, because there is an idea that the audience is aging and possibly disappearing for classical music. But that's something that you think about all the time. And it's also something that you have to balance when you put together your schedule, right? The performances for the musicians, the performances for the aficionados, right, and the performances that people will maybe discover classical music through.
Wow. I just had a meeting with our artistic committee just a couple days ago, and we had this exact same conversation. I mean, how do you balance a program for the novice and the expert and everybody in between? But when you talk about your future audiences, you're really talking about education. And one of the things that consumes the majority of our efforts at Orchestra Iowa, and it's kind of invisible to our audiences, is what we do in the schools. Whether it's bringing in students to hear a live concert for them, whether it's a family concert on the weekend for parents and grandparents to bring their kids to, or a lot of the really important and hard work where we put small ensembles into every elementary school, and yours truly goes along with them. It's somewhat like filling the ocean one cup at a time, because it's really important that young children have really positive interactions with this unbelievably great art form. Now, the efforts that we make in the elementary schools might not pay off directly for us, because life goes on and people come and go. But if we as an industry do a great job and focus more on education, then, you know, high tide lifts all boats, and because that really is our future audience.
Well, and Gretchen, I can imagine that with each performance, each piece of music that you put together as an orchestra, the musicians are enjoying this experience on a different level than the audience. Tell me more about, obviously you're hoping to inspire not just future audience members, but future musicians, mm-hmm. Tim.
Yes.
Tell me what that feeling is like from your perspective when you're performing a piece of music that you really love.
You know, I think there's just nothing like being a part of an orchestra and being a part of what's happening on stage. One of the unique things is that as musicians, we all know that what each other is doing is very hard, but we each have our own thing to do. We're not all doing the same thing. And each of us is relying on every other person on stage to do their part, but we each are kind of pulling together because we rely so much on each other. There's a lot of mutual respect and mutual congratulations a sense that we're all relying on each other. But then when we all come together and do that, we're part of something so much bigger than any one of us. And together we can make something that's just absolutely incredible. And it's just, there's nothing like it.
You're also definitely doing at least one just huge crowd pleaser this year. You do a lot of crowd pleasers, actually. Your holiday spectacular is always so much fun, but you're also performing the music to Jurassic Park, right?
Okay. Guilty pleasure. Yeah. This has actually become very popular in the industry, where you take a film and you play the soundtrack, the musical soundtrack, in real time with the film. So if we do our job correctly, the orchestra kind of disappears, because you're just enjoying the final result of the film. And, oh, yeah, by the way, the music just happens to be live. It's as a conductor, it scares me.
Yeah.
Frankly. Yeah, because the orchestra is a breathing organism, you know, and a film does not breathe or change, you know. And so to get 70, 80 people to move in a way that you're hitting your marks, that you're absolutely synchronized with the film, Well, that's my job, and everybody knows when I'm out. If I'm off by a half a second, it's like, oh, Tim.
When it comes together, it must be a blast,
it's
though.
Really fun. It really is great.
Well, happy birthday, Orchestra Iowa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tim Hangewich, director of Orchestra Iowa. Thanks for being here.
Cheers.
Gretchen Brumwell, principal harpist for Orchestra Iowa. Thank you so much.
Oh, happy to be here.
And again, Orchestra Iowa is celebrating their 100th anniversary this season with all kinds of performances. Of course, you can find out more about that online. Orchestra Iowa is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. I have personally been enthralled with the spooky bakes of Andrew Fuller for several years now. His pies that look like human faces, his anatomically correct heart-shaped cakes that ooze when you cut into them. But now everybody is in love with his work, thanks to the Netflix baking competition Is It Cake, which Fuller won earlier this year.
I'm the champion of Is It Cake. This is so much more to me than just money. I just feel so humbled by this experience, and I feel like I've kind of proven that I don't have to fit in with everybody else. You can still reach for whatever weird, wild, totally ridiculous dream you have, and you can achieve that. This has been the ride of my life.
All right, that is Andrew Fuller. When he won Is It Cake on Netflix, he is also known by his social media handle, Sugar Freak Show, and he is here with me now. Hello, Andrew.
Charity, it's so fun to be back here with
you.
I'm
so going
really
to have you back.
Try really hard to not talk in my public radio voice. It's so tempting every time. So I'm going to go back to being myself.
I love that. We all love you for being yourself, Andrew. And we were all cheering for you so hard in this series. How did it happen? How did you get to be a part of this?
You know, I was listening to the previous segment, and first of all, can I just say it's really wonderful coming in right off of the Jurassic Park theme.
Nice,
music.
Yeah, a good entrance music.
Nothing could be better. Maybe a few things, you talked a lot about the pandemic, and that kind of was the threshold that started all of this. You know, during the pandemic, people who create something that is usually used for celebrations. Large gatherings, it's kind of leaves you without a lot to do and idle hands, you know. So I kind of got bored. And so I was kind of going around my house and just picking up random items and thinking, hey, I could make a cake out of that. And little did I know that that would turn into this very niche thing that apparently the whole world needed. And
right.
Because I've done other shows, you know, I was already on the radar of a lot of these people. So...
Well, and
a lot
was,
of luck.
Right. And this was, I mean, I certainly have watched my children spend a lot of time on their smartphones just scrolling through all of these, you know, videos of people cutting into things that don't look like cake. So this was a huge social media phenomenon already.
Yeah, it was so funny because when I was reached out to by Netflix, that's kind of how they pitched it to me. You know, they said, we're doing a show based off of a viral meme. And I was like, is this what we've come to? Is this really what we've come to? But it turns out this is what we needed. You know, everything's so dark and everything's not always fun. So maybe we need to answer simple questions like, is this thing cake or is it real?
And when they approached you, you didn't have any idea really what they were even talking about. Like you went through this whole audition without an idea of what you were really auditioning for.
Yeah, they were. It's weird because, again, I've done a few shows and they were so secretive. They wouldn't tell me what streaming service it was. They wouldn't tell me really how the game was played or what exactly we were doing. All I knew is that they really liked that I did realistic stuff. So I had...
There are so many red flags about that, Andrew. Like, how did you get past that?
You know, it's funny, too, because a lot of my castmates thought that they were on... or they thought that they were being scammed. They literally would hang
it
up on the people.
Like a scam.
Yeah, it sounds really scammy. I'm probably scammable. I shouldn't probably be saying that on public radio, but I was hook, line, and sinker, ready to go in blindly.
Well, and I'm so glad that you did. You have to be so glad that you did as well. And was it a really positive experience in the filming? Because, of course, you had no idea how the public was going to respond while you were creating this.
Right. Yeah. Honestly, it sounds really cliche, but it was truly one of the most surreal and humbling experiences. I I've done other shows and it's not always fun filming things. It's fun to watch things, but right. It's not always super fun filming things. But they treated us so well. And, walking on set the first day, we didn't know who the host was going to be. We didn't know the premise of the show or how we played it or anything, literally until the moment that the camera started rolling. And that kind of works well for me because I get anxiety about things like that anyway, and I do so much better with everything on the fly. I'm not a rehearsed person. And it was just... this thing that I kind of, the whole time we were filming, was like, nobody's going to watch this. This is going to flop.
So they wanted you for your cake prowess, but they also wanted you because you are you and you're such a unique and lovely and likable individual. Was that kind of a weird part of it, though, for you? Did you understand that they're like, yes, Andrew, we want you to be yourself on television?
You know, it's funny because obviously I know that personality is a thing that they're looking like. Different personalities is a thing that they're looking for when you do these types of things. However, having said that, every time I find myself in one of these situations, I feel immediately like a sham. Mm. I feel like I'm not supposed to have been there, and I somehow catfished everybody in the production and all through the casting process. So I have so much in my head going on in that way that I don't have the ability to not just be who I am when I'm on camera. And I guess that works well for them. And I don't ever see a group of people, let alone, you know, globally, people watching a show that I'm on because of who I am. And so seeing the show the way it played out still affects me, yeah. You know, in such a positive way.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that, because you have heard from a lot of people who just said seeing you, and not talking about your cake, but just seeing you, yeah, and getting to know you through this process has been really meaningful to them, or it's been really meaningful to their child. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, you know, it's very surreal. Again, I still daily, I mean, months and months later, I thought that this would have all fizzled by now, but I get the most endearing emails, physical letters in the mail, artwork, video recordings of children and people who have children that maybe don't fit the mold or that are, you know, just kind of a little odd or have different ways of learning are a part of the queer community at really young ages, which is becoming a little easier, but still a very difficult thing, especially with the political world that we're in all the time. And I don't think that I ever thought that a cake show, a show where I was making stupid everyday items or cakes that looked like everyday right. items, would be something that resonated so much. But I hear from people who tell me that, you know, like, for instance, my child has autism, and I've never seen them react so strongly and emotionally to a person on television, and sending me videos of their kids crying and screaming when I won.
Wow.
Sorry for that spoiler. I think you already gave it.
Yeah, I already did.
But yeah, it's one of those things that reminds you that you're not just doing this silly cake show. It's the entertainment is there for a reason.
Wow.
And I wish I could have had anything like that growing up.
That is so lovely. And I'm sure that that is a really powerful thing to experience. You also have maybe the less deep part of this, which is that now you're super famous. What is that like? I mean, you probably can't go anywhere
Funny
in the world without
that,
getting
Charity.
Recognized.
How interesting is that? That was a side effect that, again, I've done shows. I guess it's a lot different when you win, and I guess it's a lot different when you win on Netflix. But, yeah, life is really weird right now. Every day I'm so confused, especially being in Iowa. I'm, like, looking to find somebody who understands what I'm going through right now because it is strange. I cannot go anywhere. You know, recently... We have season passes to Adventureland. My husband and I, we went to Adventureland, and we kind of just did a loop around the park because it was just nonstop stopping to take pictures with people and, you know, meet their kids and everything like that. And then we thought it was just an Iowa thing, but we travel a lot. And so far, everywhere we've gone, we were in the middle of rush hour traffic in Manhattan, and a cop car pulled over and they jumped out of the car to get a picture with me. And it's just
wow,
unreal. Yeah.
Now, you do have a pretty striking look. Have you been...
I'm dressed for you now, even though you can't see me.
Have you tried disguises? I mean, is it to the point where you're like, what can I do to blend in?
You know, a lot of people say that too. And it's a double-edged sword because I've tried things like, you know, leaving the house with just my hair in a hair tie and, like, wearing a hoodie and, like, gym shorts. And all that ends up happening with that is then I take pictures with people looking very sloppy.
And then you're like, please don't post this, right?
Yeah, so I might as well just deck it all out. I mean, short of, you know, I don't know, wearing a cardigan and combing my hair to the side and coloring it, you know, a normal traditional hair color. I don't really know if it would even work. I think I just am meant to stand out.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You are meant to stand out. But that, I mean, I don't want to, obviously, a lot of wonderful things have happened to you because of it. And you are clearly not complaining about the success that you have experienced.
Not at all,
I
no.
led you down that walk. I just don't want people to be like, wow.
No, I mean, honestly, and I will, I say it now and I don't foresee it changing at all, but it might annoy the people that I'm around, but I adore it. It makes my heart so happy. And every single time somebody stops me to take a picture, especially the ones that are super apologetic, you know, like, I don't want to bother you. I don't want to. As long as there's kindness and respect involved, I adore it. And it makes my whole life.
All right. Well, I hope you find the perfect balance and a balance your husband is happy with as well.
Just bring along another person. That's what we learned.
There you go. You guys go have fun. I'm going to stand here and take some pictures.
Exactly that.
So tell me, this obviously changed your life in so many ways, and you won a nice chunk of money, but it also has brought many opportunities your way. Tell me about that. What have you been able to do, and what might you be able to do because of this?
Oh, my goodness. Aside from the commercial side of things, it's really nice to have a voice that's also not just about cake. I recently, for the Iowa State Fair, I co-emceed a casserole competition, but it was for the Food Bank of Iowa. And it was really cool because it helped us kind of inform people and educate people about, you know, food insecurity in Iowa, which is something that I felt like I had a pretty good grasp on, and I really didn't. A lot of charitable things. I'm doing something with One Iowa soon. It's really nice to be able to, like, you know, to contribute in a way that before nobody would have had any interest in having me a part of, and just being there and just having, you know, the ability to reach further for these organizations is something that's been really awesome for me. But even, you know, commercially, it's insane. I already am not a good person at managing my schedule, but I have opportunities coming in left and right, both in Iowa, in LA, everywhere.
Wow.
Yeah.
You need an assistant.
I need an assistant. I have an agent. I have two agents.
Nice.
And that feels funny to say. But if you're looking for an extra gig,
right.
I always wanted a little Charity Nebby in my life.
Okay, I'll consider it.
Okay, thank you.
So tell me a little bit about the idea of opening a bakery. That's something that you've wanted to do and toyed with for a long time. I think we talked about it last time you were on the show, and that's something that I'm sure has gotten a lot easier to do in some ways, but also with as busy as you are, maybe a little bit of harder to do in other ways. What are your hopes for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a great opportunity for me to be able to talk about it because I have a lot of calls and a lot of emails. I have a cake studio. So I know a lot of people who run bakeries who talk about how difficult it is. Mm-hmm. You have to be up at really early hours.
It's incredibly challenging.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of food waste involved in that. And I want to do something a little different than that. I think that, especially in Iowa, I haven't seen anything like what my plans are. But I do have a physical space. But like you said, it's really challenging. I'm doing so much commercial work right now. I'm not even really able to take on clients for special commissions and things like that. But what I'm doing is it's Sugar Freak Show, just like me. It's kind of like me in a building. If your eyes can and your brain can imagine what that looks like, it probably would be pretty accurate. But what I want to do is have a place. It's kind of like an art studio, but it's a cake studio. It's a place where I create custom commissions. It's never going to be the kind of thing where you can just
walk
roll
in and
up,
buy eyeball cookies, right?
Yeah, I mean, and see, that's the thing. I feel kind of torn where I do feel like I want to have like, hey, come in and get your severed toe cake pop. And so what I think I want to do, this is my idea. Don't hold me to it, anybody. But the way I have my studio set up, one side of it is set up like an old Victorian theater. And so I want to open up on the weekends to the public where I'm live sculpting one of the commissioned cakes that I have.
Wow.
And people can come in and watch me doing the live sculpting. And while they're there, they can get their eyeball cookie or their severed toe cake pop or something like that. So it would only be, kind of open publicly on the weekends. And then throughout the week is just when I'm working privately on things. And it's funny because I wanted to start that in spring. And then this little show came out. And that kind of put things on hold. And then I said, you know what, summer. And then it just kept going. And then I said, Halloween's the perfect time. And now we're still probably looking at spring, maybe 2023. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I don't know, Charity.
It's exciting. When you do know, tell me. And then you can come back on and we'll talk about it again.
Sure. Well, anytime I get a chance to talk to you, it's great.
And, of course, we are approaching your favorite holiday of all time. Halloween is coming up. I know that you're going to be at Adventureland on Saturday for their Phantom Fall Fest. Are you finding enough space to celebrate Halloween in the way that you want to celebrate?
I will always find space to celebrate Halloween. I don't want to jade that for myself. And it was actually, it's so fun. I was invited to their kind of media event last night for like a soft kind of open of the Phantom Fall Fest, and just being at Adventureland in this empty space was surreal in itself, and I'm really excited to be there on Saturday.
Nice. Well, Andrew Fuller, thank you so much for talking with me, and belated congratulations. But we're all, almost every Iowan is so proud of you and proud to know that you're from Iowa.
Thank you so much, Charity.
Andrew Fuller, you know him because he won Is It Cake, the Netflix baking competition. You can also follow him on social media under his handle, Sugar Freak Show. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbie.